Love Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening and happy Shabbat to one and all. My pleasure to be with you. We have Kirk and JB here. How are you, fellas?
Good evening. Good.
Doing great.
Yeah, we're expecting Lisa sometime here shortly. She may already be on, and we just don't know what number she's calling in from. This evening, but JB has promised that he's going to check with each of the callers and find out if she's on. I do want to start with one item in the news. This just appeared on my news feed. It's from Reuters. There was a shooting back in 2007 where a group of Blackwater guards shot and killed 14 unarmed civilians and wounded 20 others in Baghdad. They have been tried, and they were convicted of manslaughter. Now, typically, you pick up a gun, and you shoot an unarmed person with your gun, aiming at them, and you kill them. That's typically murder. You know, manslaughter suggests that the killing was accidental. You didn't intend to kill them. You just might have been careless. Yeah. No, you don't pick up a gun and shoot it at women and children and cut them to pieces in broad daylight at an intersection in an urban environment by accident. So it's amazing that they were tried on manslaughter as opposed to murder. But nonetheless, they were. So a federal judge throughout the murder conviction of one of these Blackwater security guards and three of his former colleagues. His reasons were stunning. He didn't toss it out because, well, that the case wasn't proven or that the jury received bad information or there was evidence that was left off. No. He said, well, one of the guys should have been tried independently as opposed to just trying them all. It was all one incident. They were all together. They shot these civilians together. Rather than trying them all together, this one individual should have been tried independently because then he could have alleged that he was not the first one to shoot. You know, that's like participating in a gang rape and saying, well, my excuse is I was not the first one to rape her. Well, yeah. You're still guilty of rape. The second part of it was that he thought that a 30-year sentence for the murder of 14 unarmed civilians and for wounding 20 others was too severe. Isn't that amazing?
How many people do you have to kill before it's considered a crime?
Yeah, before it's really a crime.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter how many. It's who you kill and who you are that matters. Blackwater
is supposedly
former military, and you know, we worship the military in this country, so they can do no wrong.
A cord bunch.
Yeah, the cops are the same thing. You know, I'm broadcasting here from the suburbs of Cincinnati, and there's a cop that pulled over a black driver, unarmed black driver, because he didn't have a front license plate. Now, I've got two cars sitting in my garage. One of those two doesn't have a front license plate. Never has had a front license plate. So he pulled him over for not having a front license plate, which is just to say he wanted to screw with the guy. Nobody gets pulled over. If you look and pay attention, even in states where front license plates are needed, you'll notice that probably one in every five cars, one every four cars doesn't have a front license plate. And they're not pulled over. But this Cincinnati cop, nonetheless, didn't like the way this driver looked or the area that he was driving or, you know, profiled him and pulled him over. And the driver became alarmed by the way the cop was treating him. When I've been treated by cops in such a way, I have been concerned. And rather than using his words, he allegedly began to drive away from the cop. So the cop said, I was afraid for my life, so I shot him. Killed him. And he's been tried twice, and a jury is unable to convict him. Why? Because cops are considered sacrosanct in America. Now, what does a cop have to do to be indicted and successfully tried for murder?
You know, I've actually been, impaneled on a jury, but selected for, possibility of jury selection. You know, you go up. One of the questions they asked is, would you be willing to take a cop's word over a civilian's word? My answer every time is no.
No. Absolutely not. You know, the worst case ever, I think, still is Tamir Rice, where the boy was playing by himself on a carousel with a typical kid's toy gun, of which millions upon millions have been sold. And he's playing with a toy gun on a carousel. There's nobody else around. No one he's going to harm. And rather than trying to figure out if it's a toy gun, rather than even asking the kid to set down the gun, the cops pull up in a huff, and within a second of the time they screech to a halt, the kid is dead. And they wouldn't even indict him. And we just have an entirely broken system.
I actually heard someone tell me, you have to understand the mindset he was in, the day he'd had, and the situation he'd been. Like, really?
No, I don't.
That mitigates it? No, I don't. I know the facts as they existed there. There was no need for him to pull his gun, let alone shoot it.
Right. I mean, the reality is that the average human that is not in a shooting range regularly, that doesn't have uncommon skill, and that would include sub-teenage boys, cannot hit a target the size of a human to inflict deadly damage, even one shot out of 10 at more than 20 feet.
Well, they say if you run from somebody shooting amateurs, you probably won't get shot.
The likelihood of getting shot is really remote.
Yeah, very remote.
It's pure chance if you do.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And a pistol, the kind that the kid was, the toy pistol, that thing fires, the shot's going to go 20 feet above the cop's head because of the recoil.
And the recoil, too, when not
right.
Out of his hand.
And so there was the cop pulled within like 30 feet away from the kid, and at that point, and he's sitting behind the door. He's wearing a defensive bulletproof vest. The odds of that kid successfully pulling the gun, turning towards him, which the kid didn't do, pointing the gun at the cop's head and shooting that only exposed area of him and killing him was probably 1 in 1,000, maybe 1 in 10,000. And you don't give a kid the opportunity to talk him out of it first? You just set it down, kid.
Well, didn't it turn out the cop had been not fired but let go from his last police department because of he was deemed unfit for duty, but they didn't want to fire him and tarnish his record? So they basically, there was something along the lines that they let him leave on his own terms so it didn't tarnish his record and he was allowed to get a job as a police somewhere else. So the police station decided he's unfit for duty but didn't want to stop another station from hiring him.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cover your own. That's like moving pedophile priests around.
It is, and they're never held accountable. It is truly astonishing, and just one example of this after another. JB, she's on area code 734. So if you can find her, that would be great. All right, JB, you wrote a quick analysis of what you thought the three issues were with Fred. The gentleman that many of us knew, many of us liked, many of us engaged in discussions either on the phone or in person or by email or in chat rooms with, that just went completely off his rocker and started spewing some of the really most revolting anti-Semitic rhetoric I have ever encountered. In reading his letter, particularly his long, long justification letter to you, you came up with three principal issues. Can you share those with us?
Yeah. The first was, and this was really kind of a shock based on every discussion I'd ever had with him, is he's come to this acceptance of the New Testament as being, the Word of God, so to speak. At least that was what I gathered from the email he shared with me. And like I said, I emailed him back, and I was like, if I'm understanding you wrong, let me know, but I never heard back from him. But he seems to have slipped back into a bit of a Christian perspective, on the New Testament, minus Paul. He still doesn't accept Paul, so at least, credit where credit's due. Yeah, that's good. But he's doing what many Christians have done over the years.
How can you accept the New Testament and reject Paul when Paul is half of it?
You kind of love it too.
A document that even if you don't know that the rest of it is highly corrupt and highly flawed, how could you accept a document knowing that half of it was not only untrue, but probably the most deadly plague ever to infect humankind? Would that be irrational? That would be, by the way, your focus is on which is his focus these days. What do the sons say about trees? Is it possible for a good tree to produce bad fruit?
No.
So if half the tree is bad, can the tree be good?
No.
No, not according to God.
That tells you right there it's useless.
Yeah. And of course we...
But what he's done is the same thing that Christians have done for years, and he'll take, excerpts of Yahusha's words out of context to justify anti-Semitism. The Christian church has done this for years. This is nothing new.
Well, of course. But there's really nothing that Yahusha said that can be twisted to be anti-Semitic, and that's why it's almost impossible without Paul to be anti-Semitic. Paul was specifically inspired by HaSatan, by his own admission, to discredit Jews and to make the testimony of Jews seem evil. So with Paul, it's easy. Without Paul, it's impossible.
Yeah. Well, you get things like what he did with, the whole quote, I think it's from Revelation, about those who claim to be Jews but aren't. You take that out of context, you can make the argument, the Jews today aren't real Jews. Again, you take it out of context. You put it in context, and that doesn't make sense at all.
Yeah, of course, the Jews in Ephesus, that was the community he was talking to. The Jews that he was speaking to at Ephesus are Paul and Timothy. It's about as obvious as it could possibly be. At the time, throughout Asia Minor, there were lots and lots of Jews. Lots of Jews in Asia Minor for lots of reasons, including the two times of captivity, both the Assyrian and the Babylonian captivity, making their way partially back, but also lots of other issues in terms of trading. But there's lots of Jews there. But at the time, if the Jews in Turkey, and all seven cities were in Turkey, if the Jews in Turkey were not real Jews, then Yosha couldn't have been a real Jew. Then no one could be a real Jew.
Right.
So it's exactly the same people from exactly the same origin. And, of course, the his myth of the Eastern Turks being 100% of the Jews and none of the Jews being descended from Abraham through Dode, if that was true, then Yosha is a complete and utter fraud. Yah was a complete and utter liar. So that's the problem with you take something out of context and you make a whole religion out of that kind of statement. It's completely out of context with the life of Yosha. You can't focus on him and make that kind of claim. You know, the issue is that the pretenders at the time were Paul and Timothy. And those were the pretenders.
Outright admitted that.
Yeah. And it's also true that at the time there were lots of Jews who were estranged from Yahweh that were practicing at the time it was the birth of Rabbinic Judaism. And that rather than even practicing the older form of the religion that began under the Greek occupation, where the priests were still viable up to that point. You know, they now had a full rabbinic religion where the Lowi were no longer viable, and they were still using the synagogue, but there was nothing of their heritage that they had clung to. As a matter of fact, one of the issues at the time, and particularly with the Sadducees, is that they really had begun to disavow their past, and they did everything they could to become Hellenistic. They loved the Hellenistic trends and philosophies, and many of them just embraced the Hellenistic ways. So that was the biggest part of the Maccabean revolt, is a large percentage of Jews had begun to accept the Hellenistic ways, like when they started wearing the yarmulke. That round skull cap is a sun god cap that was prevalent among the Greeks and then prevalent among the Romans. And it, you know, it dates to that. That was the whole impetus behind the Maccabean revolt. So,
but you know, another possibility. Think about it. You know, those who claim they are Jews but are not. What is replacement theology? Christians claim that they are, you know, God's promise to the Jews has been transferred to them.
Oh,
they claim they are,
you
know, Jews but are not now.
Yeah. If you were to look at the that whole statement as the church becomes the seat of Satan, followed by married to Lord Baal, Jezebel, dead over time. If you look at it as what it really is, it's a presentation of the history of the religion that grew out of Paul's letters. Then what you have is two forms of replacement theology. One as bad as the other. Christianity is nothing more than the church replaces Jews. They claim to be Jews, but they're not. No, they claim, you know, all the benefits of the Jews, that they have all the promises made to the Jews. They're the real Jews now, the church, but they're not. And then you also have the Muslims, who would come thereafter, who claim that all the promises were made to them. But they're not either. So, you know, all of those things.
So there's a lot of ways that involve that don't involve an entire race becoming non-existent and being replaced by another race.
Correct.
There are plenty of ways to interpret that in context that are logical and reasonable.
Right. And, of course, that if that were to have happened, and it didn't, there's no evidence whatsoever to suggest that's what happened, and all the evidence is contrary. It would make everything God had to say about his reconciliation with Yisrael and Yehuda nothing but a bold-faced lie. It takes probably half of the prophecies in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and renders them untrue. I mean, that's not just a little bit of a lie. It means that, you know, why even discuss any of this? Because the God who authored it cannot be trusted. The other thing we talk about is that his acceptance of the Christian New Testament was all based upon the myth that
the Septuagint,
the Septuagint's creation, and that the Septuagint somehow is not fragmented and has an earlier date and is more credible than the Dead Sea Scrolls or the Masoretic text. And that isn't even remotely accurate. And we talked about that in our last program.
Yeah.
That the letter that attests to the creation of the Septuagint is unquestionably a fraud. Now, the person that it was written on behalf of him over the Alexandrian Library had actually been exiled long before that date. And the battles that it talked about that had been won had actually been lost. And it talks about six scholars from each of the 12 tribes. And at the time, only two of the tribes were Testaments. Yeah.
Goes back to the whole thing we talked about last week and his whole obsession with, don't trust man, don't trust man. Well, where did he get these facts from? Did he find this for himself, or is he trusting the word of a man? I've looked at the oldest manuscripts of the Greek text. I've looked at the modern manuscripts of the Greek text. Yeah, I don't need someone to tell me that these aren't trustworthy. I can look at them and go, wait a minute, this says this, and this one says this. So what the heck was written? Yeah, I did the research on my own. I'm not trusting a man. I looked at it. He's taking the word of a man who's telling him that, this happened, therefore this is trustworthy, which the logic in there is completely flawed to begin with, because even if the Septuagint was 100% reliable, which it's not, that does nothing to tell us what the Greek text of the New Testament is, because it wasn't done by anyone, even remotely the same person.
Yeah.
It was done hundreds of years later.
Centuries and centuries later. But, the other issue, of course, is that the whole justification was that these groups of scholars were put in separate rooms, and when they compared their translations over the short period of time, they were essentially identical. And if it was good enough for back then it's still good enough for me. And, of course, that part of the history, if you will, is not part of the original letter.
The myth.
Part of the myth. It was actually conceived by a Christian apologist some 700 years later. To believe this kind of stuff, you just have to be wholly ignorant of reality. And as I pointed out in our last program, the Septuagint was stunningly fragmented. I mean, the oldest copied fragment that we have, is a tiny little fragment of one book of the Torah, Dabarim, not even a full chapter of one book of the Torah, and it dates to about 150 to 200 BCE. So it's not nearly as old as many of the books of the found in the Dead Sea Scroll. It's in a translated language versus the original language, and it provides maybe 1/10,000th the coverage. So it's exactly the opposite. He says the Dead Sea Scrolls are fragmented, and the Septuagint's not. It dates all the way back here. But the opposite is true.
Yeah.
So and essentially he has become a pseudo-Christian, because everything for him is the sun. The sun is the sun that.
Yeah, that was...
Yeah.
Which, like I said, I've had conversations before with him, and like I said, that is one of those that hit me just out of the blue. I'm like, wait a minute. Every time we've ever talked, he was very much in the same page as me with, the New Testament is, by and large, useless.
Well, how does he deal with when when Yosha says, look to the Father or look to the Torah, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, when every one of his answers were the, you know, you need to answer this question, you know, what does the Torah say? Or when he says that no part of the Torah or prophets will be changed or be annulled so long as the heavens and earth exist. I did not come to validate the Torah, but instead to fulfill it. Yeah, of course, the fact is that we have proof of the reliability of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms in Hebrew that is older and more complete than any textual document in human history by a huge factor. And we have absolute proof that there are more variances in the Christian New Testament than there are words. You know, it is preposterous to think that the Christian New Testament is a reliable document. That's a complete and utter fool's folly. All right, what was the second?
Well, you know, that was something else he brought up in the email he sent me. Was, you know, he's like, you know, we quote all the time the not one jot or tittle line, but why not quote what came before it? And my response was simple. I quote the line about nothing being changed from the Torah and nothing about the Torah being done away with to show Christians how their God tells them to look to this. Not because I'm saying that this is the Word of God. I'm just trying to prove to them, this is what your God said. This is in your Bible. Yeah, I'm trying to get them to question. That's the only reason I ever cite that verse. So I don't cite what came before it because, again, I don't know what came before it. I don't know if he even said that line. It makes sense that he would have said that line, but I don't know that he did because that's how unreliable the Greek text is.
Correct. No, it's... the whole thing is a absolute fool's folly. If you want to know Yahweh, there's only one way to know him, and that is his word in his language and the documents that he proved that he authored, as opposed to documents that do not have validation in terms of the way that Yahweh told us we should look to determine whether or not he inspired those words or not. The second issue is the idiotic conspiracy, to use your terms, that Jews aren't Jews. And why do you think he's promoting such a ridiculous myth?
Because just like Christians, you know, they claim their authority based on the Torah. So they can't necessarily argue against the Torah without disproving their own, you know, basis. So they have to separate, you know, for him, they have to separate, disassociate the Jews that he hates and is deriding from Yahweh's covenant. Because he knows that the covenant with Abraham is for all time. So, you know, you can't, and, you know, again, you go back to the Bereshit verse, I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. So, he can't be anti-Semitic without disassociating Jews from the covenant. And so by coming up with this, the Khazarian myth, that they're, although not really Jews, they were just, you know, this tribe of medieval people who adopted Judaism en masse and ran this whole big conspiracy to convince the whole world that they're Jews. Now they're disassociated. Now he's not condemning Jews, so you can't call him anti-Semitic, and he's not anti-Torah.
But the problem, of course, is there's absolutely no literary, historical, anthropological, genetic proof of any kind that a meaningful number of Jews have ancestry that originally dates from Eastern Turkey, as opposed to the Middle East, as opposed to Israel. There are no literary documents. The rabbis were prolific writers. They talked about where they were and what they thought and who they were there with and what they were arguing about. There is no group of people that have a more prolific literary history. There's none. Literally none. The history of this tiny group of people, which almost nothing is known, converting en masse to Judaism. If they did, it doesn't make them Jews racially. just makes them observance of Judaism. However, historians that have studied that say it didn't occur. There is some evidence that some individuals embraced Judaism. But
from what I gathered, there's one document that indicates, and it's only one document that supports this, and all it indicates in the document is that the ruling class of this very small, I guess you would call it a country at the time, the ruling class converted. That's all the document says. It's the Khazarian correspondence is the name of the document.
Yeah.
And it's even questioned. It's not a, you know, we don't know for sure, but it's the only document that really supports this. And even it doesn't say the entire country did it.
Oh, no.
It's the people, small ruling class.
Right, right. There is absolutely no evidence of any kind that the people in mass, and if you're talking about genetic markers, you'd need the people in mass, as opposed to some economic or political leaders may have. And we don't even have any evidence from that culture and that place that even that occurred.
I
so even then, you don't. Yeah. There is no evidence of it actually occurring. But I think what you have here is quite simply, if Jews are not Jews, you are you can buy into the ultimate conspiracy. And hate them. And if you read his other correspondence, it was Israel that perpetrated 9/11. Jews are hidden everywhere. They're trying to perpetrate all manner of sinister schemes. He quotes people pretending to be authorities on the Talmud, saying that Jews are authorized to rape your children and kill you, and they're trying to enslave all Gentiles. And of course, they're not only taking things out of context, they're misrepresenting what's actually there. And there is none of that exists. But that's the kind of stuff he's promoting. And you can't promote that kind of stuff without engendering Yahweh's wrath. And so he's trying to, in his mind, avoid that by simply saying that, no, well, okay, so they're really not Jews, so I can hate them. What's interesting is that some of the most anti-Semitic people on the planet say, no, there is absolutely no truth to the even David Dukes of the KKK, who did a considerable amount of genetic research, said that the myth that they're from Eastern Turkey is just preposterous. Bernard Lewis, one of the most famed historians, philosophers, scholars of our day, said essentially you have to be an idiot to buy that. There's absolutely no truth whatsoever to the theme. But it is it's the nature of Christianity. Christianity began as an all-out attack on Jews because all of the text of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, which they required for credibility, spoke of the promises, eternal promises made to the Jews. And so the Jews had to be replaced by the Christian church, or they had no credibility. And so the Jews were scapegoated. They became the Jesus killers, and the rest is history. But that is where he has gone, and promoting the most sickening of the Jewish myths around every corner, trying to conspire together to control the world. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, there's probably has never been a more benevolent, non-threatening people. Jews do not have a history of enslaving other people, of invading other people, of plundering other people, of,
they don't even really try and convert.
No, they have no purpose.
They aren't interested in it. Yeah. If you want to convert to rabbinic Judaism, rather than being encouraged, you're actually discouraged. Well, there's no proselytes. And that was the whole thing of the Judaizers in Paul's letters. It was so preposterous. Jews have never tried to promote their religion, ever. It's just not part of their mentality. What was the third?
They're not big on marrying outside of the religion. Yeah, they will try and keep their kids, marry a Jew, don't marry a Gentile.
Yeah, well,
they try to stay pure.
Particularly a woman. Yeah.
Well, that's inside, not outside. But that's also true of Catholicism. You know, a Catholic
Christian
is told not to marry a Catholic, or they won't, unless that Catholic non-Catholic converts to Catholicism and agrees to raise their kids in that religious culture. So, it's just the nature of that. You know, a Muslim man can marry a Christian woman, but a Muslim woman cannot marry a Christian man. A non-Muslim.
My wife was leery to date me when we first met because she was Christian and I wasn't.
Yeah. So that's very common, and it's interesting that the only country really where you could say that Jews have become homogenized, where they're still known as Jews and they still identify themselves as Jews, although very few of them identify with Judaism. They're not religious. They're secular Jews, like they're cultural Jews. But they the only country where Jews are simply homogenized, where you know, you really have to know somebody's last name. You have to know their history. You've got to hear them. You've got to know a fair amount about them to even know they're Jewish. It's in America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
America is the one country where Jews have been wholly homogenized and amalgamized into the culture. It may be one of the reasons that Yahweh is so disgruntled with America, because what is the primary instruction he gave to the chosen people?
Be set apart.
Be set apart. Do not integrate. Do not copy their ways. In America, more than any other place on the earth, they have integrated to the point of being indistinguishable. Lisa sent me an email actually earlier today, and we're still, she's given us the area code and the telephone number, but the telephone number does not show up on our switchboard, so there's nothing.
Yeah, I'm not seeing it at all.
No, it's a 734-728 number, and it is absolutely unequivocally not on the switchboard. So we're not going to bring her in unless something else happens. But she was telling me that her mother celebrates Christmas. Mother's Jewish.
Oh, a lot of my Jewish friends do. Oh, they go over and party with you. If you were a Christian, they would party with you.
Yeah. Just totally integrated within the culture.
Yeah, absolutely.
What was the third issue that you thought was germane to Fred falling prey to this kind of a conspiracy?
It's something we've talked about a lot on the show before, and that's, a lot of people get upset with, you for doing more written communication, books, we have the forum. People are like, oh, well, you get too much confusion in writing. But there's more intellect that goes into writing. And what I noticed was everything he posted, even the replies I got, or not really replies I got, but anything I got after I emailed him, wasn't a retort to anything I had to say. It was just more videos, which is all oral communication. And oral communication has a great impact on emotions. You got Adolf Hitler, Billy Graham, Paul, Barack Obama. They were all very successful with how they were able to speak. They get people to rally to them, not by reasoning, not by logic, not by the argument even, but by how
tone,
they made
by
feel.
Gesture, by their whole, the trappings around them, their personal charisma. You can't write with charisma, but you can speak with charisma.
Yeah, I remember reading a statistic, and I'm probably going to get the numbers wrong, but they did a thing where they went to Billy Graham revival, and they tracked, it was something like 50 people who were saved at the revival over the course of a year. And by the end of the year, only like 3 of them were even remotely involved in church still. And what they found actually was by the end of the first month, more than 70% of them had just completely abandoned it. Yeah, they were moved. They felt great on this emotional high from his speech, but that faded quickly. It's like any drug.
Yeah.
Your emotions are like a drug. And
right.
That's why Christians get so involved in their church. Yeah, they get this emotional high from their first encounter there, and they want to keep it up, so they keep going back. But like any drug, it's diminishing returns.
Yeah, there's
and
two issues
need more
with,
and more people.
Well, two issues with the spoken word. One is that it has no longevity. Yahweh, while he spoke on rare occasions to his people, virtually all of Yahweh's communications to us through the written word. The written word has longevity. The spoken word has not. It is as fleeting as the sound waves in the air as it passes from one person to the next. So the spoken word has no longevity. It's just used as the example of the Billy Graham Crusades, where the spoken word has tremendous longevity. It's enduring. The spoken word is enduring. The written word is enduring. The spoken word is fleeting. Everything about Yahweh, including his name, based on Haya, is all about enduring, existing for all time. There's nothing about him that's fleeting. That's why his word is written. The second issue is that, and the reason I think many of you know, you'll send me videos and ask me to watch it, and I won't watch them. I don't watch videos. And the reason I don't watch the videos is that they're way too hard to validate. If somebody writes something, if they make a claim, I can Google the source, because it'll be cited. I can Google their citation itself if they don't reference it. I can Google the claim that they're making. I can just encapsulate the claim that they're making, and right there in the medium, I'm able to stop and validate whether what they're saying is true or not. It doesn't change. I don't have to play it, replay it, hope that I wrote it down correctly. It's extraordinarily easy to validate or invalidate the written word. So
we do have Lisa on now, by the way.
Okay, so that is part of the problem. People are far more easily misled. They have a far more emotional response. They're far more prone to believe. Very few sermons are written. Sermons are an oral medium.
So you notice also, what's the difference? Biggest difference between Yahweh and Yahusha? Yahusha wrote nothing.
Nothing. No.
He gave a handful of speeches that were told he gave a handful of speeches, but he didn't write us down anything because he didn't want us following his word. What they did when they wrote his word down is the opposite of what he ever intended. He never intended anyone to write down what he was saying.
There is never one instruction for anyone to write down what he said, ever. That's a brilliant point. He directed us to Yahweh's word. He was a living manifestation of Yahweh's word. He didn't come to add to the Torah. He came to fulfill the Torah. There was no reason for us to know what he said, because all that was important is what he did. And what he did is honor the promises Yahweh had made through Pesach, Matzah, Bukorim, and Shavua. That's it.
So you know what else? What's easier to change in a history? What someone did or what someone said? Hundreds of people saw what he did. Only a handful heard what he ever said.
Right.
It's a lot easier to add words to his mouth than add action.
Yeah. And all we've got is hundreds of years thereafter a translation by someone who was not there. And only two of the books were actually written by eyewitnesses, and they were written in a language other than the one that we have.
Isn't that amazing?
And spoken in a language other than the one that we have. So we do this show and orally, and I've questioned it for a long time because I have found that the written word is far more convincing, far more effective, far more enduring. You can communicate vastly more detail. It's easier to verify. It's more easily shared. And the only reason for doing an audio program is to reinforce the written word. Mm-hmm. But anytime the show is used as, well, all I really have to do is on the Shabbat, I'll listen to the program, and then I'll communicate with my friends via social media. What you're doing is counterproductive. You're actually fooling yourself. You're creating this impression that you're part of something, that you have understanding that you really don't. I don't think it's even possible to convey the level of knowledge and understanding that is needed to make a valid decision regarding Yahweh through the spoken word and also through social media. And I think that's why when Yoshe was asked a question, he was always referring to the written word. If you want to understand, you've got to go to the written word. He didn't say, let me explain it all to you. No, he said, what does it say? What is written? And it takes
There is one other value to this show, at least what I've seen in the past, is there is a value to a bit of free-flow oral discussion. Because sometimes we will come across something that we may not have thought of, and so we can soundboard it off each other. And we've come to several ideas and conclusions that we didn't like, oh, this is definitely true. It was, wait, that's interesting. Now I'm going to go research this and write about it. But it does provide that kind of free flow of ideas that allows you to come to some conclusions you may or may not have come to otherwise. So there is value in oral discussion.
Yeah, that is a positive, that every time we go over something that Yahweh says orally as part of these programs, we derive and communicate insights that are not part of the written text. So it's augmentative. The second issue is that to communicate information in an extemporaneous way or even impromptu way, as oral communication tends to do, you really have to know the material. You have to understand it. Otherwise, it's impossible to be an effective communicator in that kind of medium. And so it does make the presenter more vulnerable. And if you can answer questions and provide insights in an extemporaneous medium, it validates and adds credibility to what you have learned and researched and conveyed in writing. Now, the third benefit and the principal reason that I do it really is because it serves as an invitation. There are a number of members of the covenant that take these programs and they post them. JB, you do on your site. But there's many people in the part of the covenant family that post these. Many of them are posted in part of YouTube, and sometimes they have significant audiences. And they serve as an invitation, and they may attract people to turn to Yada Yah, or an introduction to God, or now observations, and study and learn the truth for themselves. So, you know,
I'm all this because I heard you on a radio show.
Right.
When I first started reading through Yada Yah, I was a delivery driver, so I was in my car a lot. I didn't have a lot of time to read, but... Yeah, at the time there were the audio versions of Yada Yah, and I had those downloaded, and I played through them over and over, and listened, and I'd make notes to myself as I was going, and then I'd go look it up in the written text, and then I'd do the research on it then. But there is a lot of benefit to it.
Yeah, and particularly if you're doing an oral presentation about what you've learned and that is also available in writing, so that somebody can research it and search out the details.
Well, that's the thing. Most of the shows we do, it is based around something that is written. Yeah, we're discussing it, so there is some extemporaneousness and some, additional content to it, but the written material is still there.
Right. Now, in this particular case where we're even talking about this conspiracy drives right to the heart of the difference between man and God. So while we're not, in the last program, we spent three quarters of the program talking about the Mizmor Psalm that that Dode wrote about how he deals, how he dealt with, and we continue to deal with, fake news and conspiracy in his day, particularly that which was adversarial to Yahudah, to Jews. But here in this discussion, we're talking about one of the most prevalent themes in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, and that is mankind being in opposition to Yahweh's children, to the chosen people. And he speaks vociferously of how in the last days, the world's going to come against Israel. They're going to lose an enormous amount of their homeland. They're going to be expelled from the countries of the world because anti-Semitism will be on the rise. And that Yahweh still is going to call them home, and he's going to unify Yahudah and Israel, and he's going to celebrate their unification with him and celebrate the role that they play in the Torah. So this at least the major religions of the world, of the biggest, Christianity and Islam, are indeed based on usurping the promises that God made to his people and taking them upon themselves, and in the process demeaning the original recipients. So you don't have to feel bad that you took their promises away because they were really scum. So this lies right to the heart of what Yahweh promised. And I've never seen anything with Yahweh where he was disingenuous or where he wasn't steadfast or that he was willing to change. I've not seen anything that would suggest that Yahweh said, okay, they're my chosen people, and I know I made a commitment to a relationship with them forever. But, you know, it didn't work out the way I expected, so I'm going to change. And instead, I'm going to the most villainous of institutions, the Christian church, which I call the plague of death. They grew out of the Roman Empire that I thought was the most menacing beast in human history. I'm going to instead embrace them because Jews are bad. I mean, can you imagine going from Jews who have, you know, who from a religious point of view have been bad, but have not been bad from really any other point of view, and embracing the Roman Catholic Church, Imperial Rome, or worse, Muslims?
You got to be out of your mind.
You have to be out of your mind. Well, if we do have Lisa, you took it upon yourself to study the Khazar myth that Jews are not Jews, that they in their entirety are derived from this really remote and essentially unknown tiny community of people in eastern Turkey. When did this myth take place? Who was the principal author of the myth? Did the individual have any credibility?
Absolutely not. Arthur Kotler was a very disturbed man. His Khazar myth is even more disturbed. It's based on lies.
Now, he was not the first person to promote the myth. There was actually, in a way he was. There were two or three other authors that said, you know, in writing about a number of things, they said, you know, there's this letter that suggests that some Khazarians embraced religious Judaism. But none of them came to the conclusions that a significant percentage of Jews were actually of Khazarian ethnicity. And none of them came to the conclusion that all Jews were of Khazarian ethnicity. So this Kotler was the first person to promote that myth, correct? I think we've lost Lisa again. Her that connection was so bad that the reason I tried to clarify what she was saying because I only got every other word through my headset. I'll pick up, and JB, if you get her again, we'll bring her online.
Keep an eye out.
The Kazarian bloodline story is author Koestler. His book was called The 13th Tribe. Now, there's a reason that that Koestler was disturbed, to use Lisa's term. He was in Germany at the time of the Holocaust, and he's Jewish. And, you know, he saw his family hauled away into concentration camps. He did everything he could to try to avoid going to a concentration camp. And as it turns out, because he wanted to oppose Hitler for creating the concentration camps and trying to round up Jews and put this Jude, Star of David, and insignia on Jews, which would be, by the way, the opposite of Jews not being Jews, became a communist. Because the communists were, at the time in Germany, the opponents of the fascists and Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. He tried to endear himself to the communists in the Soviet Union, and I believe it was Stalin that decided that he didn't care much for Jews either, and he was sent into a Russian prison. And he spent several years in solitary confinement, and for many years was tortured in a Russian prison. Even though he was part of the group that caused Lenin and Stalin to come to power. So, I mean, he had some reasons to be disturbed. His autobiography was, it's The God Who Failed. He wrote a book, which he really had no expertise, but he had a compelling literary style. And he wrote a book on the knowledge of sex, and as such, he became somewhat ingratiated into the elite culture of Europe after he was released from prison. He only wrote the book because he needed money to provide food so he wouldn't starve. And when he was accepted into that community, because, you know, you write a book on sex, you know, all of a sudden you're popular. People like sex, and in that community, there was a very, very high drug use and harsh drugs, LSD and worse. And so he was known to be drugged out of his mind and had some really bad trips. But that wasn't enough for him. This is a guy who you can see is trying to escape life. Life has been insanely painful. And, you know, he has spent his life being hunted down and imprisoned as a Jew. He went from that to a form of occultic spiritualism and spent the latter years of his life, which was truncated, in the seance kind of world, of spiritualism and trying to talk to and learn from spirits, which is, you know, one of the things that Yahweh says is of the occult, the satanic in nature. And he got so twisted in it that between drugs and his seance kinds of focus, he not only took his own life. I mean, this person who's so miserable, he couldn't live with himself. He convinced his second wife to kill herself along with him. Now, we don't typically like to get into ad hominem in terms of debunking a story, and we'll debunk the story on its merits, but this is not a guy who you would want to call as a witness. You call this guy a witness in trial, and you'll be sorry you would have done so. And his entire motivation for promoting this myth, of which he himself said the evidence is scant, well, it was non-existent. In the 1970s, by the way, there was no genetic evidence and there was no DNA evidence. And the anthropological and literary evidence is non-existent. So he said that his entire purpose of promoting the myth, and he thought he could get by with the myth because nothing was known to these people. So if you say they're derivative of a people that nobody knows anything about, how do you prove that they're not a derivative of people no one's ever heard of before? So But he's only doing it for one reason. And that is he felt that if there was no such thing as Jews, if the race didn't exist, then the Christian church, which was hunting them down and killing them, and the political movements, communists and fascists, putting them off into concentration camps and killing them en masse, there'd be no reason to kill Jews if there were no Jews. And so that was the sole motivation for his myth, is that if I can convince people that there really is no race of Jews, then, well, then there's no reason for anti-Semitism. So that's a summation of Kessler's life and his history. As I have studied it, too, and I've read Lisa's accounting, when he published The 13th Tribe, there were a couple of literary agents that, you know, worked for, like, book reviewers that thought it was just a glorious book because evidently Kessler's turn of phrase is appealing. He was a good writer. Lousy researcher, but good writer. And so the literary critics, they don't know good research from bad research. They're not scientists. They're not historians. They're do you write well? And they loved it. But unfortunately for him, without exception, the historians and anthropologists, linguists, and later geneticists that reviewed his claims said it's absolutely preposterous. No validity to it whatsoever. It is strictly a political myth. That's the reality of it. Is a very troubled man produced just a pile of lies. Now, when we get Lisa back, she can take off on this. But as we study the basic communities of Jews today, we do not know, and there's really no way to know. And I know there's some people that make claims otherwise, and maybe they have some validity. I just don't know how we come about doing this. But we do not know if somebody is of the clan of Dan or Yehuda or Gad or we just don't know. But there are three major communities of Jews, and they have nothing to do with the old clans because the genealogical records, which were meticulous, they were destroyed in 70 CE when the Romans destroyed the temple. So they do not exist anymore, and so all we can really do is there's three big groups. One of them is the Mizrahi. Mizrahi from Mitzra, as in Mitzrayim, the crucibles of human oppression. These are what's called Oriental Jews from the Middle East. Jews who remained in Mitzrayim, Egypt. Jews living throughout what's called the Levant by people, which would be Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, and Israel. Jews living in North Africa. Jews living throughout the Middle East, particularly in Iraq and Iran prior to 1948, of which there were hundreds of thousands. Jews living in Yemen and the Sudan. And we know we have a lot of Jewish influence in Yemen because the Hanif part of the Quran was inspired by Hanif poetry, which was a twist on rabbinic theology. And so these are all known as the Mizrahi Jews.
The ones in Yathrib, who are they?
Pardon?
Would they be the same category here?
As who?
As the ones in
Yathrib? Yeah, I think this would be that same group.
That's still the same
group. Oh, yeah, the groups, in Yathrib, today is Medina? Absolutely. Hmm. Yes, absolutely. The Jews called into Babylonian and Assyrian exile. Matter of fact, one of the things that you found in your research, I understand, Kirk, is that Sure. When the Assyrians took the northern tribes, Ephraim, into captivity, their goal with them was not to bring them into the heart of Assyria, but instead to position
them... No, they didn't need an enemy.
No, they wanted to position them in a spot where they were sort of a tripwire, a buffer, between them and was it the Median Persian?
The Medo-Persian, yeah.
Yeah, so that was their purpose, and to serve as that buffer, they were positioned in what we would consider to be right now eastern Turkey.
Yeah.
So there were
ironically when the Assyrians were defeated by the Persians, they didn't want them there either. That's why they let them go. They don't need at that point.
Right.
They would have had a couple million people sitting there that are very good fighters.
Yeah, and at that point, they dispersed throughout the regions of the of what we consider eastern Turkey, the Stans in the Caucasus mountain region around the Caspian Sea. Some then going migrating further north towards what we call Eastern Europe and the southern Russian area, and others coming back down south, Syria, Jordan, and the like. But the fact that there was Jewish ethnicity in eastern Turkey should not be a surprise.
No.
Now, because that's where they were placed. The second group Jews would be the Sephardim. The Sephardim Jews are... Jews in Iberia, which we now call Spain, and in Portugal. What's really interesting here is when you say Iberia, and I never thought about this before,
mm-hmm.
but the name Iberia is based on Iber, and Iberium in the plural. You know what Iber is? Look up Google sometime, the Hebrew word for Hebrew.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's what I didn't think about it until you said that. But, yeah,
until just recently, Spain and that whole peninsula was the Iberian Peninsula, and that's the history of those people. That is the Hebrew word for Hebrew.
Yeah.
And those are the Sephardim.
Yeah, and that is that group of Jews, and in fact, Kirk, as you were tracing their ancestry, they're actually from the tribe of Yehuda, and they're the tribe of Yehuda broke into two branches, and there was the branch that got the scepter, the branch that didn't get the scepter, the branch mm-hmm. that kept the scepter, which was the branch
first, mm-hmm.
that delivered Dod, is the sitting lion is their symbol.
Mm-hmm.
But the branch that did not get the scepter, it's the standing lion that is their symbol, is it not?
Yes, sir.
What is the symbol of Spain?
Uh-huh, the standing lion. At least it was on the
boat. It was. Yeah.
And if you look at the
flag, with the scarlet thread.
Yes, if you look at the flags of Morocco and of North African countries, well, particularly Morocco before 1938, you will see an Israeli flag, that star. You will see it.
Yeah.
And the Sephardim were later expelled from Spain and back immigrated into North Africa. These Jews, like Maimonides, lived in Morocco, Tunisia, and also among the Berber tribes. Most people don't understand
it. And they moved from Morocco into Iberia. Mm-hmm. They moved, which is a country named after them. And then they moved from Iberia back to Morocco when the Muslims came in. And we have all this documentation from the Muslims saying, oh, yeah, lots of Jews here. Well, they became so tyrannical towards the Jews that they moved them out. So we know that there is and these are from Yahudim Jews and all throughout northern Africa and into the Iberian Peninsula. And
as far south as Timbuktu, which was a Jewish settlement among the Berbers.
Yes, correct. Now, the third
question of Lisa.
Yeah.
Lisa, with in here, I don't know what is itemized in here, but when the Southern Kingdom is taken off in Babylon, and there's about 350,000 of them taken off into captivity, only 50,000 of them come back 70 years later. Well, they're still there, aren't they? I mean, there was.
Well,
what happened to them?
Some of them became the merchants along the Silk Road and brought to Europe all their paper, geometry, algebra, silk.
So why would that
big into the silk
trade? There, I mean, it's
they spread out to every corner of the world.
Yes, and that's exactly what Yahweh has indicated they would do. Now, the largest community of Jews, what are they called, Lisa?
The Mizrahi Jews are probably the largest in Israel today, and those are the Oriental Jews. The Sephardim are the Ladino Jews, and they also, when they were kicked out of Iberia, Spain, which they helped to build, they went to the New World, to South America, concentrating in Argentina, and the oldest synagogue is right, very close to me, and Saint Martin. No, Saint Martin.
And I think seventh or eighth, the largest concentration of Jews is in Argentina.
And then,
even.
Yeah, the Ashkenazi Jews.
Yes, and then the Ashkenazi Jews. These are Jews that live within Syria, Anatolia, which is Turkey, Iraq, Iran, to a lesser extent. But they moved throughout Europe. They were manned Byzantinian trading posts, lived along the Rhine Valley. To a large degree, though, this would be a group of Jews, too, that would have been, because the Romans have documented taking the Jews from Israel up into Rome, where there's pictures of them with the menorah and other Jewish implements. They're called the Ya'ud, the money that was confiscated by destroying the temple was used to fund the Colosseum, and they were the slaves that built the Colosseum. And you see a arch, the largest arch of triumph for the Romans, depicts them right on there. So there's lots of Jews in Europe because there were two Roman diasporas. That was the first, and then the next one happened shortly thereafter in 133 to 135 CE, where virtually every Jew was expelled and brought into Europe as slaves. That's why there were so many Jews and throughout the Roman Empire.
Yes, and they also used them as carriers for food and provisions and to dig latrines for the Roman soldiers all the way up into Germania.
Yes. Yeah, that is the reason they were there. It was, you know, they weren't invited into Europe.
Yeah.
And didn't just happen to say, you know, I think we're going to leave Israel. Let's go up into Europe. No, they were dispersed throughout the Roman Empire as slaves. That's why they were there. And they were hated, of course, while they were there for lots of reasons. But first of all, no one cared for slaves, so they were treated poorly. But these slaves were better educated than their masters, and I'm sure that was irritating. And then once they were no longer slaves over time, this small group of people who were isolated ethnically, religiously, culturally, from the community, were the most successful. And so that, too, created some envy and frustration. And then, of course, with the advent of Pauline Christianity, the world of the Europeans go to war with Jews. The Jews become the Jesus killers, and everything that is Jewish is condemned, as Paul condemned Jews in his letters. Now,
you know, you have to wonder, as pure as the exiled Jews have managed to keep their bloodline, you know, I can't remember the exact percentage, but there are more Jews that hold Nobel Prizes in the sciences than any other ethnic group. There is something about racial Jews that, I'm sorry to say, they are more intelligent. Not to sound racist or anything, but there is a level of intelligence. But you have to wonder, you know, since they were able to keep their bloodline so pure, and they can trace it, you know, you take it all the way back to Abram and before that, you know, could it be that they have a more intact Nesama than non-Jewish people?
Yeah, a pure form of the Nesama, which provides our ability to think and to reason. It would be impossible, I think, to explain why somewhere in the range of half of the world's most innovative ideas, profound advances in human culture, have a Jewish origin when the Jewish people represent less than one-tenth of 1% of the world's population. Right. You know, it's like looking at terrorist acts and recognizing that 99% of terrorist acts are perpetrated by Muslims that represent 25% of the world's population or 20% of the world's population. And if 20% of the world's population are committing 99% of the terrorist acts, that kind of link you'd have to be ignorant and irrational to ignore. Yes. Well, here you have
there's the old saying, correlation isn't causation, but when you start looking at those degree of numbers, you have to start questioning correlation and causation.
When a group of people that represents less than 0.1% of the world's population are responsible for half the world's inventions of significance.
You have to start wondering, is there something to that?
It's impossible.
You
want to
know the Jewish secret?
Do it otherwise.
We don't think linear.
Yeah. Well, you know, the
that's
fact
a Roman
is that even if you don't want to acknowledge that Jews are like Einstein, for example, are they the world's greatest thinkers, even if you don't want to do that, then if you don't do that, then what you're left with is the realization that, we chose one race, the creator God of the universe, who proved that he is the creator God of the universe, chose one race to communicate 100% of what he had to say. And if he chose a race that represents 1/10 of 1% of the world's population to communicate 100% of what he had to say, that's a correlation that you ought not miss.
Well, you know, you think about it, too. Go back to, Yahweh's, I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. Yeah, it could also be interpreted as, you will be blessed by blessing them. Yeah, by allowing them into your society and allowing them to thrive, it will bless you. And by denying them, it will deny you.
Correct. Well, particularly their message, because their message is God's message.
Yep.
If you... open
and
your
our
book
message
and
is
read
your
message, yes.
Too.
Yeah, there's only one person that I know that wasn't a Jew by ethnicity, but became a Jew culturally. Just said, I'm from a citizen point of view, from a cultural point of view, I'm referring to myself as a Jew. I'm not converting to Judaism, but converting to being Jewish is Ruth. So it's ubiquitous in the story, and even like for example, I'm ethnically Goyim, and I've devoted the last 15 years to sharing Yahweh's Hebrew testimony as accurately as I know how, and I have in essence in doing that. Have become Yisrael, have become a Yahud. I have accepted what Yahweh intended with his chosen people. So that's just what he has chosen to do, and we should not forget it. Now, you were trying to reconnect, Lisa. I think I went through most of the issues, as it turns out, to Kostler's history and why he's not a credible witness and what motivated him to even come up with the theory. Linguistically, is there any any kind of support for the Khazar theory linguistically?
Linguistically, there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever to support Khazar theory. Jews are very prolific writers.
Mm-hmm.
There's not even a poem. It's a cultural improbability.
Right.
Not one single Khazar record reflects a Hebrew word in it.
No.
And the Hebrew
no
language
contains... They're not a single
loan
word.
Words, none.
Right.
There's not one. There wasn't any into the Yiddish language, which is a conglomeration. Most people think it's just High German. No. No. It's a conglomeration of 10 languages. And until the Ottoman Empire, which they used outposts there to trade into Europe, their silk to the royal families in Europe, and other things, spices and whatnot, the linguistic trail shows that there is no evidence of any Turkic loanwords until that time.
And, right. And there's no group of people in world history that have documented their perceptions and themselves more than the Jews have. And they have nothing, not a single word. The notion that that is their origin makes it absolutely preposterous. What about the biological evidence? This notion that DNA studies prove that Jews are not descended from Abraham. There are no Jews that are descended from Abraham. That 100% of the Jews today are DNA. Their matches.
DNA proves that they're not Jews.
Yeah. Okay, this is my favorite part. The European Journal of Human Genetics states, some authors argue that after the fall of their kingdom, Khazar converts were absorbed by the emerging Ashkenazi Jewish community in Eastern Europe. However, if the two haplogroup chromosomes in Ashkenazi Jews do indeed represent the vestiges of the mysterious Khazars, then according to our data, this contribution was limited to either a single founder or a few closely related men. The Q haplogroup in question is not found in the Ashkenazi females, and the genetic strain in question is present in only 5.2% of men. The admixture, including the R1A haplogroup, total does not exceed 12% of the total in present-day Ashkenazi. No.
And they are the smallest of the three Jewish communities, and it's not even 12% of them. And the men, in terms of the lead haplogroup, it's 5.2%, and the women, it's zero.
Yeah. And recent genetic studies based on Y chromosome polymorphic markers so that Ashkenazi Jews are more closely related to other Jewish and Middle Eastern groups than to their host populations in Europe. Ashkenazi Jews who have resided in various European countries during the diaspora traditionally trace their origins to Jewish people that lived in the Kodesh land before the Roman exile. Some studies claim that a substantial part of the Ashkenazim were descendants of Eastern European non-Jews. In particular, according to Middle Age historians, the Khazars from a small kingdom near the Caspian Sea converted in mass to Judaism. Well, the genetic evidence shows that that's simply not true.
Well, so does the historical evidence. There was no mass conversion, and the conversion would not have changed their ethnicity.
No. And the recent genetic studies based on Y chromosome polymorphic markers clearly showed that the Ashkenazim are closely related to more to Middle Eastern groups. And within that, there's a certain marker for a disease.
I think one of the references research that you did was talking about the Druze. And, you know, I just looked up the Druze because I wanted to verify, because there's a fairly large number of Druze in the world today. And they live in the mountains of Syria and Lebanon and the mountains also of Jordan and Israel. And they actually have a very significant shared markers with Middle Eastern Jews. And ethnicity. But there's a reason for that. They were a group of people that because they were Islamic, kind of a strange version of Islam, Christianity, and Judaism all mixed together as their religion.
Yeah.
And the Muslims, they came through there and just ripped them to shreds. The only group that would befriend them were Jews. They lived side by side for a number of years. And the Jews, the only ones that would befriend them and didn't try to kill them. And so there's more Jewish DNA among them than any other ethnic group other than they are basically Arabian. But no matter where you look, every study that's done on the ethnicity DNA and the history of Jews takes them back to Israel.
Yeah. And there was no large-scale male-mediated gene flow into the Ashkenazi Jewish community. There just wasn't.
No.
The R1A is easily explained through archaeogenetics. But I'll go on, again, writing in Science Magazine, Michael Balzer states that Kuchler's theory clashes with several recent studies suggesting that Jewishness, including the Ashkenazi version, has deep genetic roots. He refers to a 2010 study by geneticist Harry Oster, which found that Ashkenazi Jews clustered more closely with Middle Eastern and Sephardic Jews, a finding researchers say is inconsistent with the Hazar hypothesis, and concludes that all three Jewish groups, Middle Eastern, Sephardic, and Ashkenazi, share genome-wide genetic markers that distinguish them from other worldwide populations.
And so rather than validating that there are that no Jews living today have roots in Israel and tracing back to Abraham and Sarah and Yishak and Jacob. Every genetic study shows that the preponderance of their DNA is not only distinct, but in terms of genetic markers, is not only distinct, but is consistent with Jews from the Levant, from Israel. And almost no DNA would come out of the region of the Khazar. So it's the antithesis of what Fred was promoting. Fred was promoting there is no such thing as a Jew. There are no Jews that are Israelites in the sense of coming from Israel. 100% of the Jews are Khazarian. And the evidence is, there may be, in one of the three subsets of Jews today, the smallest group, there may be a 5% Khazarian trait, which is easily explained. But the fact is that 99% of Jews do not have any trait that could be tied to Eastern Turkey.
Yeah, the one study that he actually has, posted a video, someone cited, was one guy's study. And do you know what his method was?
Mm-hmm.
He took a group that lives in the region today that the Khazars lived in and used them as the genetic basis for the Khazars, and then took the Ashkenazi Jews' DNA and they compared the two. Well, the problem is, the groups that lived in that region today, where was their origin? They came from the Middle East.
Yeah, they came from the Middle East.
Right, where did the Jews come from? The Middle East.
Right.
So any relationship between them comes back to, they are all of this region. And the group living there today, which is the Georgians and the Caucasians, have a Middle Eastern origin more so.
Yeah.
They are more closely related to the Middle Eastern region than they are to the Khazarian.
Yeah.
So it's a ridiculous study to begin with.
Beyond that, the fellow that did the study has been reputed by virtually every geneticist,
everyone,
and anthropologist and historian in the world. In fact, you go back now about a decade, and Forbes magazine did a lead story on debunking the myth, and just said, you know, it's amazing that anyone would fall for something where 100% of the evidence is counter to the theory, and where the geneticists, for example, from Stanford, would say this is not a research paper that was prepared by this postdoc. A postdoc, it means that you've graduated with a PhD from some school and you can't get a job, so you go for a postdoc, which means you can continue as if you were a PhD student working for meager wages.
Lifetime student, basically.
Yeah, and they said what he is proposing is not science.
He's a young nobody trying to make a name for himself so that he can get a job based on a name. Yeah, it has nothing to do with evidence.
It's him trying to make a name for himself. His research was as repudiated by the scientific community as was the fellow that now lives in Texas, who has been completely discredited, that tried to, because he had a competitive vaccine for mumps, he tried to discredit the mumps rubella MMR vaccine, and he took into his test only those who had accepted money from a law firm that was promoting a class action suit against the MMR vaccine makers. And while he himself had a patent on a competitive vaccine, and he completely fabricated his research for his own financial reasons.
He got his 15 minutes of fame.
That's exactly the same story as this fellow that Forbes magazine absolutely tears up and spits out and cites scholars across the board from the nation's leading universities in DNA and genetic studies. This is, there isn't any part of it that's accurate. It was sloppy research, all to promote a political myth. But that's the kind of thing that unthinking people listening to online videos buy into.
Down here in Texas, we have the Creation Museum, and they make, you know, I don't know how much money the Creation Museum makes every year promoting their junk science.
Yeah. But, you know, one of the things Lisa, that you found, and I found when I did my study on this, is that there's no group of people on Earth that geneticists have been more interested in studying than Israelites, than Jews. And it's interesting here, too, that as I talked on the afternoon show with Kirk, Jews is a errant transliteration of Yahud. From Yahuda is the place, Yahud is the people, and then the plural is Yahudim. Now, in that they are one of either 12 or 13 tribes, depending on how you look at the splits of the genealogy. But they are a subset. They are the subset that from which Dod is derived, the son that Yahweh loved most, and the subset from which Yosha came. But they do not represent all of Israel. And we need to keep that in mind, that collectively they're all Israel, and that a subset is Yahuda, Yahudim, Yahud. So that's important, I think, in our overall understanding of who these people are, but that there is no group of people that is studied more thoroughly by geneticists, and the reason for that is multifaceted. You know, per capita, there's more Jews that are scientists than any other race, and so they're interested in their own heritage. Number two, they are the most influential people in the world. So that's a reason. They're the only people that have stayed together as a people throughout time, even when the 400 years of Egyptian slavery, hauled off by the Assyrians, hauled off by the Babylonians into slavery, hauled off into slavery twice by the Romans, and pummeled both by the Muslims and by the Nazis, that the only ethnic group, only cultural group, only national group in human history to survive intact as a unique people throughout the chasm of time. And so they're the most interesting ethnicity to study. And so there are literally hundreds and hundreds of DNA studies done on the heritage of who are the Jews? Who are they related to? And what you find in every one of these studies is that they are most closely related to the Middle Eastern peoples. And you would expect that because Ishmael was also a son of Abraham.
Yeah.
And so you would expect that, and that is what you find. And what all of these DNA studies say is that while the closest relatives to the Jews are the Arabs throughout the Middle East, that the Jews themselves have more common genetic markers among them that are distinct to them than they have in common with the surrounding Middle Eastern cultures, even though that's their closest cognate. And, you know, we're not talking about a study or a dozen studies.
I'm talking about every
the single most studied ethnic group in history, and what it shows is that replacement theology doesn't have a leg to stand on. I mean, even as I mentioned earlier, Lisa, who would be today, if you were to say, who's the biggest anti-Semite today? Would it be David Dukes, perhaps, of the KKK? And what did David Dukes say about the Khazarian theory?
I think we lost Lisa.
Oh, we lost it. Well, David Dukes, after spending, he's really articulate, by the way, on ethnicity. He studied the... I mean, he would love the Khazarian theory to be true. But to his credit, he actually studied genetics and the various claims on behalf of the theory and against it. And he says it's preposterous. Bertram Lewis said... Bernard Lewis, absolutely preposterous. Not any chance that it is true. And it can't be true. You know, the reason it beyond the fact that there is anthropology proves that it's not true, that the Jewish people are the most documented people in the history of humankind, and they are 100% of Yah's messengers. The reason it cannot be true is that Yah will prove that he inspired the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Every prophecy we have investigated that he has made has turned out to be true.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some that are just stunningly accurate and precise. And he says a lot about reconciling his relationship with Israel and with Yahudim. Now, Kirk, you were, you and I, when we were talking earlier today, we broke the possibility that there are a lot of people, because you trace the symbols and the movement
right.
of Jews throughout Europe and throughout the Middle East.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So you traced it throughout the world. And so there is the possibility that there are a lot of people who are Yisrael and Yahudim that just don't know it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, lots. And there's also the possibility there's some people who consider themselves Jews who may not be.
That's a very good possibility, yeah.
And while we know that two-thirds of Yisraelites and Yahudim are killed in the last 3.5 years of the tribulation. We don't know if that is that the remaining is one third of 15 million, or one third of a fraction of that. We don't know that,
no.
And we do know that Yahweh can, and we don't know how many are killed prior to that point with rising anti-Semitism. you're not going to have the kind of anti-Semitism that Yahweh predicts is going to occur. And throughout his testimony, without lots of Jews being killed. I mean, like, anti-Semitism is just a house of plague in Europe, and look what's happening to Jews then. And so we really don't know how many are killed in advance of that. You know, the second statement, etched in stone, says that thousands will benefit from his mercy by observing his the terms and conditions of his covenant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, thousands is not millions.
No.
I think
we're talking a small group of people.
Yeah, Kirk. One of the things that struck me, and these genetic tests are validating it, that once we came to realize that life was conceived based upon language, that DNA is a three-dimensional language.
Mm-hmm.
That once we came to realize that DNA is the language of life, and that language, particularly a written language, is the single most profoundly important invention. It's only been invented one time in one place. It happens to be in Israel for Yahudim. Once we realized that life is the product of a language, we knew for certain that we had a linguist, that we had a creator, that was a communicator. And once it became known that the DNA could be read, this question about how is Yahweh going to determine who comprises each of the tribes, because he relocates them by tribe during the millennial Shabbat,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, precludes replacement theology, because replacement theology has got nothing for 12 tribes. And you know, how is he going to do that with no genealogical record? It was a fairy tale. It was preposterous. It was absolutely no way that it could be done until we learned that life is comprised out of a language. And the author of that language can most certainly read the language. Man can read the language now.
Yeah, you can spin a little vowel and send it off, and they'll tell you everything you need
right.
to know.
Yeah, and I think that Yahweh's ability to read the DNA does not need it going to a laboratory. That's how he is going to determine who gets to settle in what place.
Yeah.
And as he promised, the scepter will be with Yahudah. They will rule. Why do we know they're going to rule? Because guess who's king?
Dod.
Dod. And Dod be a Yahud.
Yes, he do.
Yes, he is.
Very much. Let me ask you a question. This is,
sure.
This is something I thought today. This is off the wall, but you often say, and it's agreed, that he's going to return everything the way it was back in the days of Eden.
Yeah, and with Adam and
let's say he returns to Jerusalem.
That was a theory that I had 10 years ago.
Uh-huh.
It was just my understanding of what, if you read everything together, it looks like the Moed Mikre are designed to take us back to where we began. And the Millennial Shabbat looks like it was designed to take us, coincide with it, to take us back where we began. But what was once just a theory, just an extrapolation over what I was reading, now is an affirmed fact. Yahweh says it so many times over and over again, that he's returning the earth to the conditions that we found in Eden, that I would say at this point, you can take that to the bank.
Okay, now Roy and I had this conversation one evening, and we were trying to determine that when Yahweh ratchets himself up and returns as a set-apart being, but certainly much more powerful, and his light, in essence, if you don't have the covering of the Ruach Kodesh, then you could melt by, be disintegrated. And we thought, you know, we talked, and well, does that mean there no one else out there outside of the group that he's returning to? Do they all die instantly, or are some of those people still there? And as you know, Rory is such a practical thinker, he's trying to say, well, wait a minute, some of these people have to be there. And I used to think, well, no, that, I don't know. I have a hard time with that. But in the garden of, if we return to the garden,
there were lots of people.
Well, that's exactly what
you know,
that's
so
exactly
if
what
Israel
is so. They don't have to be. Do they have to be Yehudim or Israelite, or they just some left residual people from all these wars of all this time?
Yeah, let's just say that if it's like the Garden, and Israel becomes the New Eden, and there are lands around the New Eden that have people, is it possible that there are still people that are not Yehudim? And not part of the covenant that survive his return. I think it is possible for the following reasons. One is it is it does mirror the conditions around Eden. And number two, what Yahweh is saying that he eliminates every person who is religious, every person who is militaristic, every person who is patriotic, every person who has come to harm Israel or his chosen people. So, could there be goyim that that exist that weren't in opposition to him, that were sort of neutral?
Yes.
Who, during that period of time, could possibly come to know him?
In South America, they could be, you know, in tribal groups in Australia, Aborigines, you wouldn't know.
One of the problems here that we have to be careful of is that sometimes we think of tribal groups in Africa, not knowing enough to be dangerous. But keep in mind that most of the tribal groups have a witch doctor, have a
shaman.
Polynesian people that came into Hawaii. These were tribes that you would say were about as isolated as anybody can be. The religion they imposed. Between priest and king, practiced human sacrifice, killing tens of thousands of people in very small communities. So, there's a lot of people who you would think of as living in the backwoods and aboriginal that you might say, they haven't done anything wrong, they haven't been religious, they're not military. Well, that's not really true. So, I can't imagine a scenario where Yahweh allows anybody who has been overtly religious or is overtly religious at the time, overtly political, overtly militaristic, harbors anti-Semitism, for example, to survive his return. I think those who are opposed to his chosen people and opposed to his manner and nature, I think, will be destroyed. But there is the possibility there could be mortals who can become immortal should they accept Yahweh and his covenant, and could become stay mortal if they do not, that could in fact survive, and I'd be surprised if there weren't.
Yeah. Well, there is a little remnant somewhere that's going to turn at the very end, because there is that little period of time when
those people have to come
and gets released. And whether it's up in Russia, as they project, or whatever, I don't know who those people would be that they would. Whether that's speculative, because we don't really have anything told much about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know who those people would be. So.
Yeah, and there are. There's also going to be a number of us.
A lot of children born.
Gentiles. There's a lot of Gentiles who are going to be celebrating. We know, beaming brightly, celebrating Yahweh's return. And so we're not going to be settled in Israel. We're not derived to any of the tribes, but those are covenant members who have had the opportunity to become transformed to spiritual beings prior to the beginning of the tribulation. We're going to be there.
Yes.
And I'd be surprised. For example, I'm certain that Yahweh's not going to destroy animal life.
No, he loved animal life. He said it was good.
And mankind is an animal. So there's just no reason for him to destroy all humans. Just how he, in the flood time, he destroyed all humans with an asoma in that particular region because they become so vicious. Viciousness and religiousness were the threshold. That was the determining factor. So, having an Osama, vicious, religious, manipulative. And so those who are religious, political, vicious, militaristic, to be consistent, they have to be destroyed. But there were Homo sapiens as animals in other parts of the world that weren't killed. Well, why would he be any different?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the point. I don't like to be in a position where I would be in opposition to a theory that is being promoted by Roy, because he's just too sound a thinker, particularly on
well, I don't mean to speak
like,
on me.
Like
that's
this.
My recollection of a long time
but,
ago.
But, you know, and in this particular case is like almost every other case that I've heard one of his propositions. And I think 9 out of 10 times I agree with him. And the 1 out of 10 times, and this is one of those times, like what you guys were discussing, I agree with. I don't know if my agreement is too limiting. I don't know if you guys were broader than my view of it. But
it's just speculative. You know, you get chatting about things. What do you think about this? And well,
I don't think you have to be all that speculative, Kirk.
Yeah.
Because
well, there's certain things that seem to be.
He's consistent. What did he do? What were the conditions around Eden at the time? There were other.
They knew there were people out there.
Right. What were the conditions after the flood? Other humans, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, yeah. Going through his implant.
Right. And when he is talking about destroying, he doesn't say he kills every human except Israel.
No.
No, he says he wipes out the religious and the political and the militaristic, and they're the ones that are gone, and all their artifacts, they're gone, and they'll be bowing down and be judged. But he doesn't say that he's going to wipe out every animal.
I'm going to wipe out.
Right.
No, he doesn't.
No. So to be consistent and to be to avoid extrapolation, I think that Roy's conclusion, your conclusion, is valid.
Yeah.
And I think it also makes life more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like I am very hopeful. I have the highest expectation that when we are out exploring the universe, there's going to be an enormous amount of life. I think that it's life that makes exploration, going camping out, fun. I mean, I can look at a beautiful mountain ridge or a beautiful stream, that's a beautiful stream and a mountain ridge, but it's so much more interesting to see a deer walk by or a mountain lion.
It's very exciting and stimulating the minute that thing starts to move and you go, wow, look at that.
Yeah, life is the most interesting thing. So, I mean, I'm expecting dogs and other forms of animals to be not only companions, but to be life of interest that we'll be examining. And so, why wouldn't preserve some humans and still give them an opportunity during that period of time?
Yeah.
Makes sense to me.
So why else would the world continue to exist for that 1,000-year period?
Right.
Yeah, you have to have food grow, so that means the ecosystem has to be there. So,
right.
Yeah.
And you got to have farmers, and you've got to have people that produce.
Yeah, they're doing them into the plow and the plowshares, the guns and the plowshares, so you know this.
Right, one. Yeah, there's not going to be any weapons. I mean, so there will be nobody in the military, because we know that, and there will be nobody in a religious community, and there will be nobody that will be political, and that's just not going to happen, But
think of the waste of all the military for 6,000 years.
Yeah. But by the way, you have to be really careful if you see one of those people say, well, I think I'll just, I know, it's such a waste. But you got to be careful of recognizing that by the time we get to that point,
mm-hmm.
it's not a matter of wiping out a bunch of people. Man's bad choices and his weapons and his use
of
weapons are going to already render the planet. If we are 7 billion people today, based upon all the things that he's explained we're going to do to ourselves and that happen within our solar system between asteroid strikes and earthquakes and the natural disasters,
yes.
wars.
Nuclear winter.
And I think that it's you'd be foolish to think that more than 1 or 2 billion of the 7 billion are going to still have survived. If that many,
I think it's a smaller number than that, but that's just me.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting too. But one thing that Yahweh would not want, I don't think, is having an enormous number of people under, you know, the age of like 12, kind of an age of consent, if I were to throw an age out there, under the age of 12, living in communities where access to information is prevalent. I don't think he cares that there's lots of babies in an Islamic world because there's not one chance in a billion they're going to come to know him.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he cares in any super religious community. But in Europe, the United States in particular, those kind of places, having a bunch of people under the age of 12 kind of creates a little bit of a problem. They ought to be able to go into the millennium with the opportunity to make a choice. But, you know, many of their parents are going to be religious and political and militaristic. Okay. So,
there's going to be a whole lot of babies.
Now, one of the things that's really interesting about all this is that in Europe and in America, where we have studied this now for a period of 30 or 40 years, in the last 15 years, male sperm count has fallen by 50%. And it's within 5% now of causing men to essentially be infertile. Be unable to bear children. And first to have something, it's so essential as human reproduction by way of male sperm fall 50. I mean, if it changed 2% over 15 years, you'd say, wow.
That's rather radical.
Yeah, that's.
But 50% in 15 years, I mean, it's just so profound as to not even know how to encapsulate that in words, but it's so consistent with humankind evolving. The second law of thermodynamics, we're degrading, and degrading rapidly as a species. Yeah, he does. There is, and sometime here in over the next week or so, we will post the research that was done by Lisa. In fact, there's a whole section on some of the research that Roy added, and it's been now integrated into the document. And we'll post that for folks to read. It's got. Robin made some really astute observations. That's part of the text. Your analysis. James is part of the text. Some of my analysis of the history of the Septuagint is there. Psalm 118, Mizmor 118 is part of this text. And so we'll continue to pull it together. I thought I was going to get more done this week, but I spent 2 days painting. I'm done with my painting now, Kirk. You'll know that I'm not going to threaten you as a.
So hang up your brushes.
And hang up my brushes. I spent 2 full days being grandpa. In fact, the next 2 days of it is today was mostly grandpa, and so is tomorrow and the following day. That is the
those
job.
Those
are
the nice days.
That's the job I love most in the world. I'm not kidding you. That is the thing I love most to do is be grandpa. I just love my little granddaughter. She owns me, man. I want to tell you, it's so
got you wrapped around her little finger.
Oh wow, yeah. But
people keep saying that about my daughter. She's got me wrapped around her
finger. Oh, absolutely, isn't it lovely? I mean, the things that you would do for her, the things that you just enjoy playing with her, enjoy sharing with her, and you know, walking with her, holding your hand as you're walking and lifting her up. Oh, it's just. exposing her to new things. You just get a sense of this is how God designed us. I had a marvelous experience, and I spent 2 days moving my son to a new apartment and where he's going to school. So I did not make much progress this week.
It sounds like you made a lot of progress. On this particular project, you had a lot of progress.
And I don't feel guilty about that in the least. And the reason I don't is that what we learn and what we share is a labor of love. And we do it because we enjoy doing it. But even as he engaged with people, like when he engaged with Dode had a life.
Mm-hmm.
Yosha spent 30 years as a stonemason. You know, so God doesn't mind that we do stuff and we experience life. It makes us real. It's all part of the whole.
Go back to the metaphor. Do you mind that your sons are off having lives of their own when you're not around?
No,
you enjoy that.
Yeah, and I actually enjoy helping him. You know, moving is not a fun experience, but helping your son out is.
Yeah. Well, it's the whole thing, you know, absence makes the heart grow fonder. You know, that time away makes you appreciate the time with them. If all your time was spent with them, it would not be as meaningful.
They're special.
Yeah, correct. We're in complete agreement. Anyway, that's what's happened. It's not an excuse. It's just it's the way life is. And I knew we were going to be listening to Lisa. I didn't think I was going to be doing this summation of much of her research, didn't it? We had connection issues, but whether I was summarizing her research as I had read it or she was presenting it, it's the same material, and we're going to post it before too long. It's a very thorough repudiation. And it brings us really back to this idea, J.B. and Kirk, that to believe the conspiracy that Jews are not Jews and that they're devilish people lurking and trying to manipulate the world. That's the oldest and most vicious, the most ungodly of all conspiracies and fake news. And every aspect of it is so easily disproved. And the evidence is, you know, a million to one counter to the little slivers that are taken out of context and twisted. That you really have to want to be misled.
Yeah, you're looking for to support your theory.
It's willful ignorance.
It's willful, and it goes from ignorance to putting yourself among those who will be destroyed when you begin to promote it. Yeah, when you begin to promote it, it's one thing to be fooled by conspiracy. It's one thing to be fooled by fake news. It's another thing to promote it.
Yeah.
You know, there is, to be fooled by it, you're going to die.
Yeah.
Your soul's going to cease to exist.
And that's sad.
And, you know, that's sad, but that's no penalty.
It's not that bad.
To promote an anti-Semitic lie and to do so aggressively, you know, that puts you in the group that's going to spend eternity in Sheol. That's a really bad thing to do. That's the first time when I saw these, went to the Facebook site, read all of this delusional diarrhea. And the first thing I said is, you know, be careful. You know, it's sad to have wasted your life and soul to have been sucked into this and to be misled, but another thing, you know, and there is even a solution for that. You know, if you stop,
walk away.
You can be reconciled, to the family. There is no solution for that.
Well, it's even more horrible that the people that are doing it have read the Torah and accurate translations.
Right.
And
they know Yahweh's name and use it.
They know Yahweh is. And what his plan was, how do you reconcile that to your brain that is all of a sudden, huh? Oh, it was the first two tapes I looked at, I thought, this is the stupidest stuff in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know,
it's
you
even
have
hard
to look stuff
to
up
listen
to know this
to
is
those
wrong.
Videos because just the very cursory overview of what these people are saying is so obviously wrong.
Yeah.
That it's very difficult to even imagine how anyone would believe
into that.
Why would you be sucked into that? I find the whole thing just flabbergasting. It's so obnoxious, so obviously untrue that you find yourself just shaking your head and say, why would anybody go there? And then they just dig themselves
what's
in
to be
further.
Gained?
I don't know. I mean, I just.
All you can do is prove
that's what I don't get. Why waste your time? Say you believe this, but you know Yahweh's word. Why not spend your time there?
Why
not? I mean, your time can be just spent so much better. Even if this were true, this whole Jews aren't Jews thing was true, does it make you closer to Yahweh knowing that? Does it make you closer to your relationship with Yahweh through exposing that? No. Go to the Torah. Go where you can grow.
One of the things that strikes me, too, is that if you're pursuing some conspiracy out there that even if it's true, it doesn't make any difference. You know, for example, let's just say that 9/11 was an inside job. That's not true. But if it was true,
yeah.
What difference does it make in terms
of
anything that matters in life? What difference does it make? Now, in the case of anti-Semitic material, this is the issue. That's why I said, you know, if you want to degrade rabbinic Judaism, you better really be careful. Because if what you're doing isn't put in the right context and isn't very specific, this has nothing to do with the race and ethnicity of Jews or really even Israel, then you're going to come across as in opposition to Yahweh's chosen people. And that is a curse, the one curse in the Torah. That's a bad thing to do. So I don't have any issue with somebody saying, you know, the Talmud is false, and it's arguments against the Torah, and here's the ways that they have gone astray. But you need to do so accurately and consistently and in a manner that, it's just I'm talking about the religion here, not the race. The same thing is true with Israeli politics. And really, unless there is a really important reason to bring it up, you just ought not go there. That's one of the areas that there's just no reason for you to be opposed to the Israeli government. If you want to be opposed to a government, be opposed to your own.
Yeah. If you live in Israel and you want to oppose their government, that's fine. But you're talking about like the whole religious aspect. You know what Ken Powers did with the 616 mitzvah. That's a very valid way to go about and systematically attack the Jewish religion. It wasn't the most effective way, but that you want to do something like that. That is a well spent use of your time. Yeah, this is what they said. This is what the Torah says.
Right.
How do they get from here to here? You're attacking their stated beliefs, not them, not not a group, but this is what they say they believe. Here's what the Torah says.
But you're attacking.
If you want to address it in that regard, go for it.
Go for it.
But you do that with the context that you're trying to enlighten the victim so that they can walk away.
Yeah, exactly.
But if you're going to win, and this is what's so damning, is that if you are not doing so accurately, you've misstated the Talmud or the Mishnah or any of the rabbinic writings. If you misstate them, and then you extrapolate and say, this is the thought process of Jews, you move from religion to race, and then you begin to demean Yahweh's chosen people because of the words of a few, now you're in real trouble. And you moved from being wrong and focused on the wrong thing to putting yourself in opposition to God. And so that's really That's really the last place you ought to go. And, you know, you ought to realize that when Yahweh is criticizing the Jewish religion and the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, the religion that he is criticizing is not Rabbinic Judaism. Rabbinic Judaism did not exist.
It's a Babylonian
at the time
religion.
That right. Yeah, the religion that they're practicing is Babylonian.
Catholicism.
And the religion that he's criticizing has enormous amount in common with Christianity.
Yeah.
And has very little in common with today's Rabbinic Judaism. So that was one of the first things began to realize. They were talking about Astarte. Well, Astarte has nothing to do with Judaism. It has all to do with Christianity.
Yeah.
That's Easter.
Mm-hmm.
That's Mary, Mother of God, Queen of Heaven. It's Roman Catholicism.
It's the very thing that Ephraim got involved in. And that's what blew it for them.
Right. And so almost all of the aspects of militarism and religion that Yahweh is criticizing are practices that we see today, and the practices that grew out of Babylon having nothing to do with Rabbinic Judaism. So, Judaism is fair game to criticize, as is secular Israeli politics. But you need to be very careful what you say, because they are the chosen people. They are the messengers of Yahweh's testimony. And you have to always put it in context. For example, you're going to criticize the Talmud. You need to understand that the Talmud arose around 500 CE when Roman Catholicism was harassing Jews and killing them and torturing them. And it's in that context that it was conceived. You need to know that. And if you want to criticize the Israeli government, then you need to understand that there are 1.5 billion Muslims that surround them, and the governments that surround them want to annihilate them, and they're weaponized to do so, and their country is infiltrated with jihadist terrorists that will knife them down and run cars into them.
Well, the thing is, to effectively expose something, you have to do it from that mindset. It's like what you did with Islam. You didn't go in, I'm going to expose Islam to rub it in the face of Muslims and make them feel stupid and degraded. You did it out of, I want to help these people.
Right.
And that's the only way to effectively expose anything, is from that position of, I want to help those who have been hurt by this. I don't want to rub it in their face. I don't want to make them feel stupid. I don't want to degrade them for it. I want to help them. That is my goal. And it's the same thing. If you're going to go and expose Rabbinic Judaism, it needs to be of the mindset of, I want to help those who have been trapped by Rabbinic Judaism. I don't expose Christianity to demean Christians. I do it because I want them to see the truth. I want them to know where they are wrong so that they can, dismiss that and accept the truth.
Right. Yeah, I wrote yada yada, not to demean Jews, but to awaken Jews.
Exactly.
Right.
And that's the only way it's ever effective. Nothing written to degrade the person is ever going to convince the person that they're wrong.
Yeah. No, I think there are some exceptions to that in the sense of, Prophet of Doom quickly came to be disparaging of Muhammad because, what other way is there to look at somebody who's a pedophile and a rapist and a mass murderer and acknowledge...
But was it disparaging of Muslims?
No, it was not designed to be disparaging of Muslims, but to be disparaging of Muhammad, Allah, the Quran, and all aspects of Islam. But
in that same regard, if someone wanted to criticize Maimonides, that's different.
Yes.
Yeah, you're criticizing the individual,
criticizing
the people that follow him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are certain individuals where the ad hominem argument is fair game. If somebody claims that they alone received the message of God,
they are God's
analyzing their credibility now is an absolute valid and necessary tactic. has to be done. Like this theory on the Jews coming from the Khazarian region of the Khazarian peoples that were little-known people in East, were now as Eastern Turkey. The author of that theory, who is such had such a miserable life, he's fair game because without
his credibility is on the line.
Correct.
Yeah.
You know, we defend as a group the chosen people because Yahweh does. Is he critical of them? Absolutely. Is this critical of them fair? Yeah, it's fair. It's contextual. It's fair. Accurate. And so long as we do the same thing for the same reason and say that this is the consequence of being misled by these people and this is the advantage of knowing the truth, and what we're doing is useful. It's worthwhile.
Yahweh's criticism of them was always in terms of trying to call them back. He's trying to point out, you're doing this and you're doing this. Stop it.
Correct.
Come back
right.
to me. You know, it was always done with the intention of helping them.
Right. Even the divorce is presented with a reconciliation. And keep in mind, the divorce wasn't from Yahudah, from which we derive Jews. That is correct.
Right.
From Ephraim.
Even that was a long time out. You know, he didn't say, I'll never see you again, or you'll never have another again.
Yeah, it's as directly presented, juxtaposed with this is the reconciliation. This is when the reconciliation is going to take place, and understand that while you are not my children, then you will be my children.
That's right.
And so he's presenting the reconciliation right along with it.
Yeah. We'll address that when we do Leviticus 26. He basically, Yahweh says, this is the deal. And he's talking to all of them. He's talking to Yehuda as well as Israel. And he says, this is... If you do this, this is how I'll prosper you. This is how you'll grow. This is how you will
And then if you do these things,
however, then there's a point where he says, however, if you don't, this is what's going to happen to you. You'll be chased all over the world. You'll run and be scared when no one's even chasing you, and such and such and such. And then at the very end, he says, however, if you turn back to me, you're mine. You know,
it's
just a beautiful thing. It's a terrific thing.
It is, yes. And it requires racial Yahudah to have survived. It does not require religious Yahudah to survive. There really isn't such a thing. It's such a fantasy to call it Judaism because there's no tie to Yahudah. With it, the rabbis were thought that the whole notion of what tribe you're part of, Yahudah or Loi, was irrelevant. As a matter of fact, they fought the whole concept of the Loi being service to Yahweh. So they discounted ethnicity in its entirety. So rabbinic Judaism should not have been, the same name should not have been used to describe the race. That was a disservice to the race.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
good. All right, guys. Thank you.
Well, it's our pleasure. Always a good time. Thank you, JB.
Yeah.
Your stuff
well,
is good, and this was great and as well, and I enjoyed sitting in with you. Thank you very
Kirk
much.
Kirk, we'll analyze what you've learned in terms of the Torah promises next week on observations and on this program, guys, we'll return to Chapter 9, where we're going to talk about the evolution of translation and the reasons why translations are so universally corrupt.
Perfect.
Sounds fun.
All right. Thanks. Good night.
Bye.